7 p.m. Come join us for the best in bluegrass.
Right here on 90.1.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston at 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. The next election is scheduled for May 3rd, and early voting began on April 22nd and will run through April 29th. Polls are open for early voting on Sunday the 27th from noon to 7 p.m. and on Monday and Tuesday from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. After Tuesday the 29th, your last opportunity to vote in this election will be on Election Day, Saturday, May 3rd. As near as I can tell in Harris County, there are no elections within the city limits of Houston, but there are numerous elections in surrounding towns, cities, school districts, utility districts, etc. Outside of Harris County, check the website of your election clerk or county clerk to find out what elections are being held in your precincts. You can also go to the Texas Secretary of State at votetexas.gov. I will preface the rest of this information with a reminder. I think we've all learned the hard way that there is no such thing as a trivial or unimportant election. Local elections may still be the most important elections in the sense that they are most likely to directly affect you, your children, your quality of life, your water service, etc. This time around, in Harris County at least, the elections are for bond propositions, school board trustees, and more. The deadline to apply for a mail-in ballot was April 22nd. That's passed. In Harris County, you can early vote at any polling place in the county. I strongly encourage you to vote as soon before Election Day as possible, because stuff happens. You can find voting and ballot information at harrisvotes.com if you live in Harris County, or at votetexas.gov for anywhere in Texas. If you're in Harris County, I've linked to what's on my ballot in this show post. Looking at the countywide sample ballot, not everyone will have elections this time around. You can find a personalized sample ballot there, and you may or may not have an election now. I'm going to read a list of the places in Harris County that are having elections for positions or bonds or other things. This list is as complete as I could ascertain, but it was a long ballot, so I might have missed something. There are elections for positions and or bond propositions in the following places: the cities of Friendswood, Jersey Village, Nassau Bay, Pasadena, South Houston, and West University Place. Also, in Humble ISD, Clear Lake ISD, Waller ISD, and Tomball ISD, as well as the Lee College District and the San Jacinto Community College District. There are also elections in the Cypress Forest Public Utility District, Harris County Emergency Services District No. 5, Harris County Freshwater Supply District No. 1A. There are Municipal Utility District elections, or MUDs, in the Green Trails MUD, as well as Harris County MUD Numbers 16, 105, 118, 167, 182, 188, 230, and 1570D as in David, as well as Maid Creek MUD. Other utility districts with elections are the Harris County Water Control and Improvement Districts Numbers 74, 92, and 116, Hunter's Glen Mud, Memorial Hills Utility District, West Harris County MUDs numbers 5, 10, and 15, Oakmont Public Utility District, the Weston Municipal Utility District, and last but not least, the Trail of the Lakes MUD. Again, I urge you to go to harrisvotes.com for your personal sample ballot, and remember that you can bring that sample with you to your polling place for reference as you cast your ballot. Interestingly, May 3rd at-large council elections for Spring Valley have been canceled. I'm providing a link in this show post so that you can use that to view election updates if you're in Spring Valley. Also, interestingly, elections for three positions on the Spring Branch ISD Board of Trustees are not being run by Harris County, so they're not at harrisvotes.com. Early voting and election day are still scheduled concurrent with the regular elections. Election day is still scheduled for Saturday, May 3rd, 2025, but if you are in Spring Valley, you will have to click on the link I'm providing in the show post to learn about that ballot. HarrisVotes.com, as I said, will not have that information. Again, elections for the Spring Valley ISD are still being held concurrently with state and county elections, but under different auspices. But if you are in Spring Branch, you will have to click on the link I'm providing in the show post to learn about the ballot. HarrisVotes.com will not have that information. Again, elections for the Spring Branch ISD are still being held concurrently with state and county elections, but under different auspices. Yep, nothing encourages voting participation like making things this easy. Sarcasm alert. Our first story is from CommunityImpact.com. Texans urged to prepare for disasters with tax-free emergency supplies April 26th, 27th, and 28th. Certain emergency preparation supplies can be purchased tax-free in Texas from April 26th to 28th, according to an April 21st news release from the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts. The tax holiday was approved by the Texas legislature in 2015. Comptroller Glenn Hagar said in a press release that Texans can purchase tax-free emergency supplies for events that can cause physical damage, such as hurricanes, flash floods, and wildfires. The tax holiday starts at 12:01 a.m. on April 26th and ends at 11:59 p.m. on April 28th. Hagar said, quote, "Don't wait for disaster to strike. I'm encouraging Texans to take advantage of this tax holiday to save money while stocking up for emergency situations," unquote. There is no limit on the number of qualifying items that can be purchased, including household batteries, fuel containers, and flashlights priced below $75, hurricane shutters and emergency ladders priced below $300, and portable generators priced below $3,000. A complete list of qualifying supplies can be found on the Comptroller's website, which I've linked to in the body of this story. Per the press release, delivery, shipping, and handling and transportation charges are part of the sales price for purchases made online. I'll note, as per the webpage, that emergency preparation supplies sales tax holiday, again, is from April 26th through the end of the day on the 28th. Since the first broadcast of this show is on Sunday, April 27th at 1 p.m., you have the balance of this Sunday and all day on Monday the 28th to take advantage of this tax-exempt day for emergency supplies. I'll note in passing that I always consider these sales tax exemption days to be a sop to citizens, so they think they're getting a generous offer from the state. A line in the story that I didn't initially read says, quote, "The Comptroller's office estimates Texans will save about $2.3 million in state and local sales taxes," unquote. Saving 8.25% on a major purchase is no small thing, but I think that a better way to serve the Texas consumer would be to abandon the notion that Texas should be a flat tax state. Instead, lower the sales tax and introduce a progressive income tax, which, you know, there's now a constitutional amendment against, thank you, Republicans. And that would bring in more sales from consumers around the borders of Texas. This would help to make up for the sales tax rate cut and also generate business and jobs for Texas businesses and workers. Perhaps an idea worth considering? In property tax news from theleadernews.com, HCAD encourages homeowners to take advantage of homestead exemptions. The Harris Central Appraisal District, HCAD, is encouraging homeowners to make sure they have the homestead exemptions that they're entitled to. Said Roland Altinger, chief appraiser, quote, "One of the easiest ways a homeowner can lower their property tax bill is to file a homestead exemption and apply for any other exemptions they might be eligible for. The state tax code mandates certain exemptions, and many jurisdictions offer optional or additional percentage exemptions, unquote. A homestead is generally the house and land used as the owner's principal residence on January 1st of the tax year. Recent legislation allows a homeowner to apply for a residence homestead exemption the year they own and occupy their house as their principal residence. If the owner acquires the property after January 1st, they are eligible to receive the exemption for the applicable portion of that tax year immediately on qualification if the previous owner did not receive the same exemption for the tax year. However, the homeowner must apply for the exemption for the applicable portion of that tax year before the first anniversary of the date the homeowner acquires the property. Altinger said, quote, "Homestead exemptions can reduce the appraised value of your home and, as a result, could lower your property taxes," unquote. Available homestead exemptions include school taxes. All homeowners may receive $100,000 of a homestead exemption for school taxes. On age and disability exemptions, individuals 65 years of age or older, or disabled as defined by law, may qualify for a $10,000 homestead exemption for school taxes in addition to the $100,000 exemption available to all homeowners. Also, any taxing unit may offer a local optional exemption of at least $3,000 for taxpayers age 65 or older and or disabled. Older or disabled homeowners do not need to own their homes on January 1st to qualify for the $10,000 homestead exemption. They qualify as soon as they turn 65 or become disabled. There are local option exemptions. Taxing units may offer an exemption based on a percentage of a home's appraised value. Any taxing unit can exempt up to 20% of the value of each qualified homestead. No matter what percentage of value the taxing unit adopts, the dollar value of the exemption must be at least $5,000. There are partial exemptions for disabled veterans. Texas law provides partial exemptions for any property owned by veterans who are disabled, surviving spouses, and surviving children of deceased disabled veterans. This includes homesteads donated to disabled veterans by charitable organizations at no cost or at not more than 50% of the good faith estimate of the homestead's market value to the disabled veterans and their surviving spouses. The exemption amount is determined according to the percentage of service-connected disability on January 1st of the given tax year. There is a 100% residence homestead exemption for disabled veterans. A disabled veteran who receives 100% disability compensation due to a service-connected disability and a rating of 100% disabled or of individual unemployability from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is entitled to an exemption from taxation of the total appraised value of the veteran's residence homestead. Surviving spouses of veterans who qualified for this exemption or who would have qualified for it if it had been in effect at the time of the veteran's death are also eligible with certain restrictions. The resident's homestead application must be filed if this exemption is claimed. Surviving spouses of members of the U.S. Armed Services killed in the line of duty also get exemptions. The surviving spouse of a member of the U.S. Armed Services who is killed or fatally injured in the line of duty is allowed a 100% property tax exemption on his or her residence homestead if the surviving spouse has not remarried since the death of the Armed Services member. Surviving spouses of first responders killed in the line of duty also qualify. The eligible surviving spouse of a first responder killed in the line of duty is allowed a 100% property tax exemption on his or her residence homestead if the surviving spouse has not remarried since the death of the first responder. For more details on homestead exemptions, contact the Harris Central Appraisal District at 713-957-7800. I'll read it again, 713-957-7800. Or by web form at www.hcad.org. Property owners may obtain an application online at www.hcad.org under forms. You should make sure you take advantage of any and all of the special deductions to which you are entitled. It's your right, and it can have a major impact on the affordability of your home. I once had reason to investigate homestead rules at one point in the past. As I understand it, you can only have one homestead. That's a national rule because it not only determines your property taxes and any exemptions you may be eligible for, but it also determines where and how you may vote. As an example, I have a primary homestead in Houston, Harris County. We own another home near Texas A&M. That is not our technical homestead, even though we make regular use of it, so it gets no homestead tax exemptions. It also is not our voting address. That is registered at our official homestead in Harris County. If you own a homestead in any county or city and then buy what is termed a second home, even if it's in another state, you can still only have one official homestead for taxing purposes. Voting purposes too, but they don't have to be the same. Now, you can have a voting address designated outside your technical homestead, but just because you designate a residence as your voting address, that does not automatically make that address your official homestead. So, the more you know. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. We excerpt some stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 90% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. There's more information on our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and you can look for me on Threads and Blue Sky at Think Wing Radio. A brief mention of a story from CommunityImpact.com. League City designated as music-friendly Texas-certified community by the state. Governor Greg Abbott announced League City has been designated by the Texas Music Office, or TMO, as a music-friendly Texas certified community, according to an April 21 news release from Abbott's press office. The music-friendly Texas program was introduced by TMO in 2016 and, quote, seeks to foster music business-related economic development and job creation in Texas cities and communities, unquote, the press release notes. League City is the 80th music-friendly Texas certified community and the 9th in the greater Houston and Galveston area, according to the program's website. There is more to the story, and you can go to the show post and click on the article link if you're interested. I only include it because I thought it was worth mentioning, but not worth spending a lot of airtime on. Next from CommunityImpact.com, new developer proposes residential concept for Lake Point redevelopment. Lovett Commercial, a Houston-based real estate developer, has proposed a residential-focused project for the former Floor campus in Sugar Land. The new proposal comes after Sugarland-based developer Planned Community Developers redevelopment plans for the campus stalled, city officials announced in August. PCD's vision for a $1 billion mixed-use site called the Lake Point Plaza was not selected by the city. The plan included residential, retail, office, and community spaces. A new proposed development, dubbed Lake Point Green, could take a trail-oriented approach surrounding various types of housing opportunities, Lovett officials said at an April 22nd joint Sugar Land City Council and Planning and Zoning Commission meeting. Lovett officials said the 53-acre development would include 2 acres of multifamily housing totaling 699 units, 31 acres of townhomes, duplexes, and multiplexes, and 10 acres of civic and recreational space. Several city council members and planning and zoning commissioners, including council member William Ferguson, shared their concerns about the proposal's lack of retail options. Additional concerns from others included the proposal not having enough parking for residents and guests. Ferguson said, quote, "I would love to see some high-end retail, some high-end dining, high-end something that could become completely walkable," unquote. However, Lovett President Frank Liu said the company is focusing on the market demand for housing. He also said he believes it's too early to ensure retail could be successful at the property. Liu said, quote, "Putting retail here today is suicidal. 5 years from now, maybe. Still suicidal. This is just not the right location for retail. Maybe someday, 50 years now, 100 years from now, people's traffic patterns can change, but not today," unquote. Additionally, Mayor Joe Zimmerman said non-permanent retail, such as food trucks or pop-ups, could be considered to add the retail mix. Meanwhile, a multifamily development called The Pearl is undergoing city permitting for its project located adjacent to the vacant Floor site. Developer Morgan Group will bring 385 units with the 6.5-acre community, Community Impact reported. In addition to 1- and 2-bedroom housing, the site will also feature 9,600 square feet of flexible co-working office space, 4,425 square feet of meeting space, a fitness and gaming center, a cafe and coffee shop, and five live work units which combine residential and business space. The project is expected to be completed between 2027 and 2028, according to the city's website. Lovett hosted a community meeting on April 23rd to engage with nearby residents and receive feedback on the proposed development. Meeting seats were limited to those in the immediate area of the project. Redevelopment Planning Manager Ruth Lohmer said that, additionally, City Council and the Planning and Zoning Commission will host a joint public hearing on May 6th, where Planning and Zoning Commissioners will share the board's recommended action. Council is expected to vote on the item at a May 13th meeting. If approved, Lovett officials expect to begin the phased project in 2025 with first housing deliveries in 2028 and completion in 2034. I strongly encourage residents nearby this project to go to the May 6th meeting. Whichever project goes forward, this is a major development that the residents of Sugarland will have to live with for many decades. I'm including in this show post the link to Sugarland's public hearings page. If you're interested in attending or just learning more about it, you can click on that link. Next, from CommunityImpact.com, Conroe City Council discusses potential citywide development moratorium. During its April 23rd and 24th meetings, Conroe City Council discussed the potential of a citywide development moratorium due to constraints on water capacity, as recommended by Norman McGuire, Assistant City Administrator and Director of Public Works. Amid rising concerns over water infrastructure, McGuire and Jason Miller, Assistant Director of Public Works, discussed the potential for a citywide development moratorium. The northern portion of the city is already under a temporary development moratorium, as previously reported. McGuire said at the April 23rd workshop, quote, "It's a very serious matter, and this might be the time to look at more drastic action when it comes to the boundaries of the moratorium to include consideration of the entire city of Conroe. I know that's a lot to swallow, but we are looking down that road," unquote. Miller said last April the city was producing 15.4 million gallons of water a day. This year, the number has increased to 17 million. Miller said, quote, "We went from a connection point of almost 41,000 connections to over 49,000 connections. That's extreme growth, so there's huge concerns that we have. The city is at 85% water capacity, which is still within the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality threshold, as previously reported. Before the development moratorium was enacted in August, the city was at 96% capacity," McGuire said. McGuire said the city has added water well number 27 online and plans to add more infrastructure, including water plant 29, anticipated to be online in July, water plant number 30, scheduled for completion in the fourth quarter of this year, water plant number 32, for which a bid has been awarded, and the bypass line to water plant number 15, with construction set to start soon. McGuire said, quote, to sum it all up, all the projects just described are going to put a scratch on the surface of the situation that you're looking at, unquote. Council member Harry Hardman said enacting a citywide moratorium is a nuclear option. Hardman said April 24th, quote, "Before we trigger that nuclear option, I want to make sure we get it because we have one shot at this," unquote. Council member Marsha Porter said in the April 23rd meeting, quote, "I don't want to be in a moratorium, but if that's what we have to do in order to protect the citizens that we have now, that's what I want to do," unquote. Last April, city staff first raised concerns with city council about the strain on Conroe's water capacity, according to prior reporting. By May, officials estimated that addressing critical infrastructure needs would require approximately $50 million in funding, again, as previously reported. In response, City Council approved implementing seasonal irrigation restrictions last June, limiting watering from May through October to help conserve water amid growing demand. A temporary development moratorium for the northern portion of the city was then enacted in August before being extended in December and again in April. City officials will present a more in-depth look into the city's water infrastructure needs during a special City Council meeting at a later date. To my mind, important elements of this story are missing. For example, the story only mentions a municipal well once in regard to Water Well 27. All other references are about water plants being added. What is the nature of these water plants? Are they wells, purification plants for surface or groundwater, sewage treatment plants that generate potable water, or perhaps water that is only suitable for agriculture and irrigation? If new plants are exclusively pumping and treating groundwater, that creates concerns for the long-term health of aquifers as well as long-term concerns about subsidence. And note that aquifers used by Conroe are not infinite and are not the exclusive property of Conroe. Aquifers run under other areas that might also need and tap into them. If these plants are for purifying surface water for city use, Conroe is also competing with other municipalities needing that city water, that surface water rather, either now or in the future. Who apportions it? I feel that many important questions are left unanswered in this reporting. I emailed the reporter for further information, and after repeating the same questions I just asked you, I said I feel that many important questions are left unanswered in this reporting. Can you elucidate? On Friday, I got this response from the reporter. Quote, "Thank you so much for your email. Our story about the city council discussion came from the meeting itself and therefore did not include any information that was not discussed at the meeting. However, we are working on a longer story about the water capacity concerns within the city for our upcoming issue, and I will make a note of your questions so we can potentially include them in that longer, more in-depth story," unquote. It's impossible to say if my email had anything to do with that future in-depth reporting, but it's nice to know that inquiries to community impact are heard. I think that this exchange also points up how important it is for reporting to go beyond press releases and transcripts when writing a story, and to consider the implications of the actions reported in these press releases. There is frequently a need to think of the inferences beyond the words and actions described in government releases. Thank you, though, Nikayla Shaheen, for your response to my questions. This is ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax-deductible, and some may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too. Last week, I mentioned that Mayor John Whitmire is basically a conservative, even though he's technically a Democrat. This next story from Cron.com is another example that supports my analysis. It's called "Democrats May Admonish Houston Mayor Over Dan Crenshaw Fundraiser." Members of the Harris County Democratic Party signed a resolution last Tuesday to formally admonish Houston Mayor John Whitmire amid a looming fundraising event he plans to attend for GOP U.S. Rep. Dan Crenshaw. Roughly 30 precinct and congressional chairs with the party signed the resolution, which accuses Whitmire of undermining the values and mission of the Democratic Party. Per party rules, precinct chairs are not allowed to endorse, fundraise, or support candidates from opposing political parties. This resolution applies the same rules that precinct chairs must comply with. The resolution additionally outlines that Whitmire would not be allowed to seek endorsement from the party in future elections. A spokesperson with the mayor's office told Cron that Whitmire has consistently stated that he will work with anyone in the best interest of the city of Houston to get things done. The spokesperson said in a statement to Cron, quote, "He is proud of his record in the Texas legislature, where he built relationships and earned a reputation for working across the aisle to benefit Houstonians. Nothing has changed. He maintains the same work ethic as the mayor of Houston." I'll personally note here that there's a difference between working across the aisle and fundraising and supporting candidates across the aisle. That's maybe, you know, a ballot too far. Continuing, per a report by Abby Church of the Houston Chronicle, the precinct chair's statement described Whitmire's agenda as, quote, "indistinguishable from that of a MAGA mayor," unquote, taking issue with Whitmire having stood on the sidelines when it came to the trickle-down effects of the recent administration. Precinct chairs notably called out the Houston Police Department's involvement with U.S. Immigration and Enforcement, Customs Enforcement, ICE. The statement said, quote, "We deserve to have a fighter who wants to represent us, not a willing enabler of an emerging dictatorship," unquote. The statement added that if Whitmire wanted to be a Republican, that was okay, but he shouldn't count on the support of thousands of grassroots volunteers. who shed blood, sweat, and tears to knock on doors and elect people who represent, quote, our values, unquote. The resolution will need to be brought forth to the party's resolutions committee before it is presented to the party as a whole for a vote. Since first running to replace the late Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, who went on to serve in Congress before his death last month, Whitmire has garnered praise from Republican colleagues for his ability to work across the political aisle. Whitmire rallied support from progressive and conservative voters in his battle to sit at the city's helm, handily defeating the late Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Houston's mayor is nonpartisan. However, Whitmire was a Democrat in the Texas legislature for decades. Whitmire joined Crenshaw at a fundraiser last Tuesday night on April 22nd, which has stirred up notable criticism from Democrats and progressives. Political experts noted that it's not unprecedented for elected leaders of major cities to collect support from those outside their party. If the resolution comes before the full party and members vote to admonish Whitmire, it will not curb any authority the mayor has as an elected official in his role. There is a follow-up to this story from the next day from HoustonPublicMedia.org. John Whitmire faces backlash for attending GOP Representative Dan Crenshaw fundraiser, critics say MAGA Mayor. A group of Harris County Democratic Party officials are criticizing Houston Mayor John Whitmire over his participation in a fundraiser for U.S. Representative Dan Crenshaw, a Republican. 30 precinct chairs signed on to a formal admonishment, which was first reported by the Houston Chronicle. It, quote, condemns the political behavior of John Whitmire and finds that his conduct undermines the value and mission of the Democratic Party, unquote, and it calls for the party to deny endorsements in future elections. According to Mike Doyle, the county chair of the party, the admonishment will be voted on by all 591 precinct chairs. In a statement, the group said, quote, we deserve to have a fighter who represents us, not a willing enabler of an emerging dictatorship, unquote. Arguing Whitmire, quote, stood on the sidelines during the Trump administration's authoritarian takeover of the United States, unquote. Precinct Chair Cameron Coach Cam Campbell told Houston Public Media, quote, I don't have to necessarily love all of your policies to agree that we're teammates on the same page, but the moment you decided to fundraise for a Republican, you made a decision to stop being our teammate. Like, that is, if you ask me, that is treason. That's treason, unquote. As Whitmire exited the fundraiser for Crenshaw on Tuesday evening, protesters shouted, MAGA Mayor, unquote. A spokesperson for Whitmire said he has consistently demonstrated he will work with anyone in the best interest of the city of Houston to get projects done for Houstonians. I might note it wouldn't kill him to campaign for a Democrat to do those things, but anyway. Continuing, University of Houston political scientist Brandon Rodinghouse told Houston Matters on Wednesday, quote, there's been long discussion among Democrats in the region about Mayor Whitmire's partisan leanings. The fact that he now has kind of thrown in his efforts to help a fairly conservative member of Congress definitely solidifies some of those concerns, unquote. Pointing to a daunting budget deficit, which Whitmire has said could be helped by state and federal funding, UH political scientist Geronimo Cortina added that, quote, any help that the city can get in terms of money, I think, is going to be welcomed by residents, unquote. In addition to the formal admonishment, the local Democratic precinct chairs are also pushing for an update to the party's rules that would prohibit Democratic candidates in partisan and nonpartisan races from endorsing, fundraising, or appearing in political advertising for Republican or Republican-endorsed candidates. In Dallas, I'm noting, longtime Democrat Eric Johnson was elected mayor in a technically nonpartisan race. He switched parties on September 22, 2023, and became a registered Republican. That resulted in a failed recall effort by folks who felt he deliberately misrepresented himself as a Democrat just to get elected, and that amounted to a fraud against Dallas voters. I'm linking to that story from 2023 in a reference link below this story post. I'm not directly comparing Whitmire's political ambidexterity to Johnson's party switch, and Johnson's case doesn't do much for the case of eliminating nonpartisan elections because that might not have made much difference in Johnson's election to mayor. But it does say something about political honesty to the voters about where your true political sympathies lie and coming clean about them during an election, not after. Dallas Mayor Johnson is likely to serve out his term, which ends in December 2027. That's when the next election for Dallas mayor takes place. There's a nascent effort to recall Mayor Whitmire, but he is likely to survive as mayor until Houston's next mayoral election, which is also in November of 2027. Here's a little Latin paraphrase that fits the situation. Caveat suffragatores is Latin for let the voters beware. Let that be among our important watchwords. Next, from the TexasTribune.org, Texas school districts got their first A to F grades in 5 years. See how your school did here. Texas released long-awaited grades for school districts on Thursday. It's the first time that scores for underperforming schools have been made public in 5 years. Under the state school rating system, all districts and campuses got a letter grade for the 2022-23 school year. Of the nearly 1,200 districts evaluated in the state, 10.4% got an A, 73% got a B or a C, and 16.6% got a D or an F. Fort Worth ISD is at risk of shutting down a school or facing a state takeover because of failing grades. The 2022-23 school year ratings had been held up in courts after several districts sued the state to challenge changes to rating standards. But the 15th Court of Appeals earlier this month cleared the TEA, the Texas Education Agency, to release the ratings, ruling Commissioner Mike Morath had the authority to make those changes. TEA still cannot release the ratings for the 2023-24 school year because of a separate lawsuit. Before then, schools went without ratings for the 2019-20 and 2020-21 school years because of the COVID-19 pandemic. They got partial ratings for the 2021-22 school year. Public education advocates celebrated the release of the ratings, which they say can help parents see how successful their local school districts are and help businesses decide which communities to invest in and school boards to identify areas for growth. Critics of the A to F system say it harms districts that serve poor communities, which are more likely to get failing grades and face state sanctions for them. Districts and each of their campuses are graded on an A to F scale based on three categories. Student achievement, which is how well their students perform on state standardized tests and whether they're ready for college and careers. The state imposed higher standards to get an A under the new rules. School progress, which is how much students are improving on state tests, and closing the gaps, how well schools are boosting scores for specific groups of children, like students with special needs and English language learners. Each category is weighted differently. 70% of the overall grade comes from the better score between the student achievement and school progress categories. The remaining 30% is based on the closing the gaps category. Now, included in the story, I'll note, is a search box labeled search for your district or school to see how they did below. And this is where you can see what ratings Texas schools or districts received in the 2022-23 school year. The story explains that, quote, each school district and campus receives a rating which is based on the three categories: how students meet graduation benchmarks and perform on state tests, their improvement in those scores, and how well schools are educating disadvantaged students. The better score out of the first two categories, as the story mentioned earlier, the student achievement and student progress, counts for 70% of the school's overall grade, with the remaining 30% based on closing the gaps. Using the search box I noted is a little tricky. For example, typing in HISD gets you nothing, but typing in Houston ISD is what it takes to get a response. So how you write it matters. Be guided by that requirement if you decide to go to the article and search for schools or school districts. Now, this is the response given for HISD. Overall district rating C. In this district, 189,290 students were enrolled in the 2022-23 school year. Of those, 79.5% were economically disadvantaged, much higher than the statewide average of 62.1%. A C on student achievement, the category based on star performance, college readiness, and graduation rates. A C in school progress. This category shows students' growth and performance compared to other schools with similar amounts of economically disadvantaged students. D on closing the gaps. The category shows how well schools are at making sure students of all backgrounds are successful. Now, as noted in the body of the story, critics of the A to F system say it harms districts that serve poor communities, which are more likely to get failing grades and face state sanctions. So HISD has a ways to go, but maybe part of the problem is a lack of government support for students coming from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. Texas fancies itself to be a so-called bootstrap state, where if you fail, it's all your fault, based on the I built it philosophy. Democrats know that life is more complicated than that, and lending a hand is more useful than leaving someone holding an anchor. Next isn't exactly a story. In a post that's since been deleted for some reason, Blue Sky user Anvil Hammer said this, "I always ask, or what? What happens to him if he defies the SCOTUS? The U.S. Marshals report to the Department of Justice, that is clearly now a division of Trump, Inc. What is the plan when he crosses that line? Again, beg Republicans to please do something and have them put party before America again?" That's the post. Now, the first line in that quote caught my attention. I thought that Anvil Hammer asked exactly the right question. Or what? What happens if Trump takes Andrew Jackson's reported position on a SCOTUS decision? Google AI expressed it thusly. Andrew Jackson famously challenged the authority of the Supreme Court, particularly regarding its rulings on Native American land rights. While the Supreme Court ruled against Georgia's laws regarding the Cherokee Nation, Jackson refused to enforce the decision, famously stating, quote, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it," unquote. He also appointed 6 justices to the Supreme Court during his presidency, shaping its direction. That's from AI. Now, does this start to sound familiar? Trump is all too willing to accept court orders that favor him, but criticizes judges who rule against him. In spite of court rulings, Trump has been denying the due process rights of people snatched off the streets and people sent to El Salvador. This is especially ironic given the fact that Trump uses a crazy amount of due process, but he gives immigrants, even legal immigrants, little or none. Now, increasingly, the courts are telling Trump that all people within the United States, regardless of legal status, are entitled to due process. And increasingly, the Trump regime has at least implicitly been forcing the question, or what? In a story that hasn't gotten nearly enough coverage, Politico reported that Rubio's State Department is telling employees to report on one another for anti-Christian bias. This is a place where totalitarians of the left and the right totally, if I may make a pun, agree. It's essential to make tattling on family, friends, neighbors, and co-workers a patriotic act. This is a tactic that was used in Mussolini's Italy, Hitler's Germany, and Stalin's USSR, also in the book 1984. It was fairly successful at getting children to denounce family members, and of course, people with an axe to grind were only too happy to denounce people they didn't like. It's even reminiscent of the Chinese Cultural Revolution of 1966 to 1976, where Chinese citizens were strongly encouraged to denounce people who were perceived enemies of the revolution. With little or no due process, even by Chinese Communist Party standards, denounced individuals were often marched through the streets with placards around their necks proclaiming their counter-revolutionary crimes before being sent to re-education camps. That is one answer to, or what? How far is MAGA now from these sorts of acts? Once the regime gets to the stage of asking for ideological denunciations, how far down the road are we? And if we get to this stage, it's way too late to ask, or what? The question then will be, what now? We dare not wait to act against these sorts of outrageous demands posed by the Trump regime, because once we're asking, what now? It's way too late. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show by listening to archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. Again, that number is 713-526-5738 extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Blue Sky at Thinkwing Radio. Next is actually an audio story, which I will be commenting on. The U.S. is no longer a reliable partner. Mark Carney responds to Trump tariffs. On March 28th, Canada's new Prime Minister Mark Carney made a speech to Canadians that also has far-reaching implications for the long-term economic and security health of the United States. I'm going to play an edited version of that speech because I think it's important that Americans hear it and understand just how badly Trump's actions have damaged our relationship with Canada. I've edited it for time. I've also shortened breath pauses but tried to keep the dramatic pauses intact. I've also taken out the Quebecois French. Otherwise, the English version of Carney's speech is complete and runs about 7.25 minutes. I've included a video link to the entire press conference, including the Q&A that followed, which is in both English and French.
Good afternoon. Bonjour tout le monde. Today, my cabinet colleagues and I met to discuss Canada's response to the latest developments in the trade crisis. Yesterday, in the latest salvo in his trade war, President Trump again imposed unjustified tariffs on our nation in violation of our existing trade agreements. This time, he targeted the auto industry and the more than 500,000 hardworking, dedicated Canadians that that industry supports across our country. Now, the President of the United States is trying to fundamentally restructure his economy, means our economy, and it means the global economy as well. And I understand and respect his goal to support American workers, but I disagree with him that this is how to help them. With time, it will become apparent that these actions will end up hurting American workers and American consumers. I reject any attempts to weaken Canada, to wear us down, to break us so that America can own us. That will never happen. And our response to these latest tariffs is to fight, is to protect, and to build. We will fight the U.S. tariffs with retaliatory trade actions of our own that will have maximum impact in the United States and minimum impacts here in Canada. We will protect our workers and our industries during this difficult period. But above all, we will build a new Canadian economy. We will build Canada strong. Coming to terms with this sobering reality is the first step to taking necessary actions to defend our nation. But it's only the first step. Last night, the President of the United States reached out to schedule a call. I appreciate this opportunity to discuss how we can protect our workers and build our economies. I will make clear to the President that those interests are best served by cooperation and mutual respect, including of our sovereignty. Let's be clear. We're all on the same page. We won't back down. We will respond forcefully. Nothing is off the table to defend our workers and our country. Now, to my fellow Canadians, I don't want to set unreasonable expectations. The road ahead will be long. There is no silver bullet. There is no quick fix. And I know and I understand that many are feeling anxious and worried about the future. Fundamental change is always unsettling. But I have every confidence in our country because I understand what President Trump does not. That we love Canada with every fiber of our being. Because we are stronger when we are together, and Canadians are uniting as never before. Now, we are going to have to live the lessons of recent months. First, that we have to look out for ourselves. And second, that we have to look out for each other. The federal government will do everything in its power to protect Canadian workers and businesses. We will be here for you every step of the way. In the past week, my government committed to use every dollar collected from our retaliatory tariffs to protect our workers. Our biggest challenge as a country is becoming the most urgent. Over the coming weeks, months, and years, we must fundamentally reimagine our economy. We will need to ensure that Canada can succeed in a drastically different world. The old relationship we had with the United States, based on deepening integration of our economies and tight security and military cooperation, is over. What exactly the United States does next is unclear. But what is clear, is that we, as Canadians, have agency. We have power. We are masters in our own home. Nous sommes maîtres chez nous. We can control our destiny. we can give ourselves much more than any foreign government, including the United States, can ever take away. We can deal with this crisis best by building our strength right here at home. It will take hard work. It will take steady and focused determination from governments, from businesses, from labor, from Canadians. We will need to dramatically reduce our reliance on the United States. We will need to pivot our trade relationships elsewhere. And we will need to do things previously thought impossible at speeds we haven't seen in generations. But we can make ourselves more productive and therefore more competitive. We can break down internal trade barriers. We can build a stronger and more resilient economy. And that's what I'm squarely focused on as your Prime Minister. During my first 9 days as Prime Minister, I came to an agreement with the provinces and territories to remove all exemptions under the Canada Free Trade Agreement. As a federal government, we created a first mile fund to provide capital to build transmission and transportation networks to link extraction sites to rail lines and roads. My government is committed to removing any labour mobility restrictions for federally regulated professions by Canada Day. And we're now working with the provinces to identify projects of national significance in order to accelerate the timeframe to build them. We will create an all-in-Canada network of supply chains for the auto manufacturing components straight through to Canadian steel and aluminum and critical minerals. And we committed today to create similar strategies in other sectors that are under threat from President Trump's tariffs. All of these initiatives will go a very long way to offsetting the costs of these tariffs if they are permanent, and they will help to realize our potential as a nation. But there's even more to do. And that's why I chose to go to France and the United Kingdom, two long-standing and reliable partners, friends, and allies of Canada. And it's why the time will come for a broad renegotiation of our security and trade relationship with the United States. It's why I will work intensively with our partners in business, in labor, the territories, and the provinces to find more ways to help Canadians through this crisis and to ensure that our great country emerges stronger than ever. In recent weeks, Canadians have done their part to unite in defense of our country, to unite also in defense of our way of life. It's my solemn promise as your Prime Minister to do the same. It's my solemn promise that when President Trump threatens us again, we will fight back. We will fight back with everything we have to get the best deal for Canada. We will build an independent future for our country stronger than ever. We will stand up for Canadian workers. We'll stand up for Canadian business. We'll stand up for our history, our values, and our sovereignty. We will stand together to build Canada strong, Canada free, Canada forever. Thank you. Merci, and I'll be happy to take your questions.
Essentially, Donald Trump has managed to F up one of the decades-long best international relationships in the world within just 2 months of becoming president. Make no mistake, the United States may never be able to rebuild this relationship to what it was. Even getting close may take generations, which is the time it will take for this ignominy to fade from living Canadian memory, but it will never be erased from Canadian historic memory. Trump's betrayal of Canadian trust and loyalty may be the most serious since the War of 1812, when the United States invaded Canada with the hope of taking it from Britain and annexing it to the United States. It took over 100 years for that distrust to begin to fade in Canada, but trust me, they still learn it in history class. And when it comes up in conversations with Canadians, they know it very well, and I still detect a bit of resentment about it. Trump has probably brought all that historical memory back to the fore of Canadian minds. Thus, I believe that it's impossible to overstate just how serious a breach that Trump has unnecessarily created between the U.S. and Canada, and how serious the implications are for the future U.S. security and economic vitality. In short, Trump has us screwed. Some of the language I've used in this segment may sound undiplomatic and even unprofessional, but in my opinion, it's the only way to emphasize just how bad this is. At the bottom of this story post, I've linked to the entire press conference with the Q&A and the French. Trump meets Zelensky, then threatens new sanctions against Russia, from the Washington Post. President Donald Trump met briefly with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on the sidelines of Pope Francis's funeral Saturday, their first face-to-face encounter since their Oval Office blow-up in February, and then threatened new sanctions against Russia. Zelensky used the rare gathering of world leaders in Rome to launch a diplomatic blitz, meeting with several European leaders in an effort to head off a U.S. proposal to end Russia's war with Ukraine on terms favorable to Moscow. Trump, meanwhile, took to social media to criticize Russian President Vladimir Putin for recent missile attacks on civilian areas in Ukraine. It was his second public rebuke of the Russian leader since a missile strike on an apartment building in Kyiv on Thursday. Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform, quote, "It makes me think that maybe he doesn't want to stop the war. He's just tapping me along and has to be dealt with differently through banking or secondary sanctions. Too many people are dying!" The quiet one-on-one conversation between Trump and Zelensky in St. Peter's Basilica came before the funeral of a man who had repeatedly advocated a just end to the war. The intimate setting in the Vatican contrasted starkly with the chaos in the Oval Office meeting, at which Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berated Zelensky before journalists handpicked from conservative outlets. The United States this month proposed a final offer. Washington would recognize Russia's illegal annexation of Ukraine's strategic Crimean Peninsula and acknowledge other territorial gains, and would ease sanctions if the fighting stopped. The pro-Russian proposal stunned Ukraine and its European allies. Kyiv insisted on a ceasefire before it would discuss territory. Witkoff and Secretary of State Marco Rubio canceled plans to attend high-level meetings scheduled for Wednesday in London, and the meetings were abruptly downgraded. On Wednesday, Trump said he found Russia easier to work with than Zelensky. Hours later, Russia bombed Kyiv. Europe renewed its support for Ukraine's position on a ceasefire. Trump then urged Putin on social media to, quote, "caps, stop!" European leaders drafted a text to counter the U.S. proposal that addressed some of Ukraine's major concerns, including the ceasefire. It's not clear whether Washington is willing to consider a new text. It's also not clear what document or ultimatums Witkoff might have presented to Putin on Friday. But Europe's steadfast support for Zelensky was apparent on Saturday. Zelensky clocked FaceTime with allies from across the continent, including British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, a powerful partner who helped coach him through the aftermath of his White House visit, as well as French President Emmanuel Macron, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Meloni wrote on X, quote, "Seeing Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky talking about peace at the funeral of the Pope of Peace has such a huge meaning. Today has been a historic day," unquote. I'll here note in passing that Meloni's Brothers of Italy party is a direct political descendant of Mussolini's National Fascist Party. Continuing, Zelensky was greeted by a huge round of applause as he arrived at the Pope's funeral on Saturday. Other meetings between top Ukrainian and U.S. officials also took place around the funeral. It's often said that Trump can be quite malleable on policy and is often most influenced by the last person to speak to him. Perhaps Putin's failure to make Trump look like an effective peacemaker, in spite of Trump outlining a plan that would give Putin everything he wants in Ukraine with the exception of complete annexation, has made Trump amenable to being influenced now by Zelensky and the other European leaders. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. We are Houston's community media, and I hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting. I look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care. We have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside. Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Members are the single most important source of funding for 90.1 KPFT. Why don't you call right now to make your membership investment and become a part of that important source? 713-5265-738 is the number. Or you can give online at kpft.org. And if you make your membership a sustaining one, you'll be supporting this station for years to come.
At KPFT, our listeners are very important to us. Here's what they say about us.
I was out on an event at Discovery Green, and a homeless person came, and he said he needed to hear KPFT. And the only way he could hear it was on a transistor radio. And he only had $10, and he gave me the $10. And I told him, oh, you don't have to do that. And he said, yes, I do. I need to support this station. You're telling people what they need to hear. And you are affecting people's lives, because I repeat what you guys have to say to other people, even right-wingers. And eventually, sometimes I have an effect on them, and they'll come back later on and tell me what effect I had from learning from you guys and from other things. But just keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much.